So I'm going to give you a feel for the sort of things that we're doing in particle astrophysics, which has really blossomed in Canada, starting with the SNOW project, but moving to SNOW Lab, which is has the lowest cosmic ray flux internationally, similar to the Chinese laboratory, and also is ultra clean everywhere. And so it's spawning not only further measurements of neutrino properties, but also measurements of dark matter. And as a result, I mean, if you look at the span of what can be dealt with, obviously we started with neutrinos from the sun in terms of the SNOW project, but with dark matter, we're looking at the form of the Milky Way galaxy. We're looking at its effects in a larger scale. We're looking at its effects on the formation of our universe as a whole, with the conversion of SNOW to SNOW plus by putting liquid scintillator in, anticipating adding neutrinos double beta decay material to the scintillator. We're also able to study neutrinos from the Earth, because uranium and thorium make up about 40% of the heat flow from the Earth. And so from that point of view, you're studying the Earth. But of course, we're also studying properties of particles at the most microscopic level. The observation with SNOW that neutrinos change from one flavor to another, implying they have a finite mass, is something that requires something other than the Higgs mechanism for generation of mass within the standard model. And so we're working at the most microscopic level as well. So it's kind of fun. And basically, the reason why it's possible to do it is because of a natural advantage of having created essentially the lowest radioactivity location and taking great care in the experiments to make them all very low in their radioactive content so that you're not interfering with the signals. The first and foremost thing that we've been able to do is to work 2 kilometers underground in a very active nickel mine in Sudbury. I mean, they're taking 5,000 tons of ore or so a day out of the same shaft that we use to get down to our experiment. On the other hand, they're so good to us that coexisting with them is a real advantage. They keep the mine running very safely, and so we can coexist very very readily. And we're attracting significant international interest, as I'll describe later, in experiments at SNOW Lab. It has become a target location for future even larger experiments in dark matter and neutrinos double beta decay. So let's start with the SNOW experiment, which is now, we stopped taking data in 2007, so it's old news, but let me just run through it and show you what in fact was done. It's a precursor to SNOW Plus, which is in operation now. The question was a problem that turned up when an experiment by Ray Davis, starting in 1968, using chlorine with a threshold here in the spectrum of neutrinos from the sun, which you see as calculated by John Bacall and others. The chlorine experiment was looking predominantly at the boron 8 decay neutrinos, which you can see extend up to over 10 MeV. And what happened was that the measurements that were made showed about 3 times fewer than what was calculated. And so here, as of 1984, we were faced with this single number, 1984 being when we came together to work on the SNOW project, about 16 in the 16 of us in the first place, but expanding to over 200 in the longer term. The theory, calculations of the so-called standard solar model are shown here, normalized to 1. And so you're looking, in this case, at a factor of 3 lower, which was the motivation for the experiment, which has the capability of measuring not only the electron neutrinos produced in the sun, but also all neutrino types and making that comparison. Other experiments on this plot, including ones that came along later, up to the year 2000, the gallium experiments and Super Kamiokande, were sensitive either exclusively or predominantly to electron neutrinos. So you were faced with the question, are the calculations the source of the problem, or are neutrinos actually changing from one flavor to another by having the ability to look at both electron neutrinos and the sum of all three neutrino types, we were able to get around that. And the reason was the properties of heavy water, which we were able to borrow from the Canadian reserves. We could look at one reaction, which is very specific to electron neutrinos, in which a neutron is converted to a slow-moving proton and a fast-moving electron, faster than the speed of light in water, and therefore producing a Cherenkov cone, but also a second reaction in which the deuterium is basically broken apart, leaving you with a neutron as a way of detecting this reaction, and we had three different ways of doing that in the experiment. If you compare those two, then you have a prima facie case that electron neutrinos have or have not changed their type. But in order to do it, you have to be very stringent about the radioactivity control, because any gamma ray that's greater than about 2.5 MeV can do exactly this and mimic what is your second reaction. So we had to control materials, but also control, for example, the heavy water. In the center of the detector, we were able to control to the point that of uranium and thorium, which are the ones that naturally occurring that give you more than 2.2 MeV gammas. We were able to control so that we had one decay per day per ton of water. So about a billion times more pure than tap water. And we were also able to measure it to 25 to 30% accuracy. And so the fact that we were able to control it to a factor of 10 or so less than the observed reaction for neutrinos from the sun in this second case enabled us to make an accurate measurement. Now that measurement was at a rate of roughly one neutrino per hour from the sun. And so that shows you the degree to which we had to control all the rest of the radioactivity. So when we finished the experiment, the three phases I mentioned for different measurements with different neutron detection types, for the electron neutrinos, we had a signal at this level. For all three of the measurements of neutrons, we were essentially in agreement with theory. And the ratio of the two was such that about two-thirds of the electron neutrinos had been transformed into either mu or tau neutrinos en route. And it turns out through the sun is where the conversion takes place. It's understandable that you would have a difference from Super Kamiokande because there is a small fraction, about 15%, of that second reaction, the neutral current reaction, in the sensitivity of Super Kamiokande. And in fact, the first paper we published was a comparison between our results and theirs, which gave us a 3-standard deviation result. In order to get to the prescribed 5-standard deviation, we had to do the full experiment. So this is what we built, $300 million worth of heavy water on loan for a dollar. Not bad leverage in any market, although I have to say the insurance cost about a little over $1 million a year in order to put it in this unusual underground location. It's in the middle. It is in an enormous 12-meter diameter transparent sphere that had to be put together from 120 different pieces in situ, and they all had to be transported down in this shaft here and bonded together underground, surrounded by light sensors and immersed in ultra-pure light water in a chamber that had been lined with both water and radon impermeable membranes. This shows you the engineering associated with the project. It was really quite substantial. This is what the Nobel Prize was awarded for, but there was an enormous number of people, particularly 200 scientists as signatories on the papers, and I just really represent them. They're the ones that did all the work. So, if neutrinos, the current theory for how neutrinos oscillate is that flavor states can be expressed as, in terms of mass eigenstates, mass 1, 2, and 3. This turns out to be a 3-by-3 matrix if we, the evidence for sterile neutrinos is fragmented at best these days, and so 3 active neutrinos is the norm. The PMNS matrix, as it's called, can be broken down into various segments. And for the first segment here, you have measurements in with atmospheric or accelerator-based neutrinos. Solar give you the 1-2, where of course the C's are cosine and sine representations. And so oscillations are from the left of this point. When you get into double beta decay, you're using the same elements, but you have to add in a couple of phases. This gives you oscillation phenomena if you're dealing with vacuum, but in the sun, you can have an interaction with the high electron density. In particular, electrons have the ability to interact by W exchange, whereas all neutrinos have a Z exchange or Z exchange. Depends on which side of the border I'm on. I better say Z here. Effect of that is that you can have a potential transition in the sun, and that appears to be what has happened. So the effect of all of this and a lot of other experiments in the meantime, accelerator-based, reactor, and atmospheric neutrino-based, is that we have really a pretty good idea of all of these parameters, with the exception, in fact, of that of a couple, one being this CP violating phase that comes in this area, which is being sought with Dune and Hyper-K, but also the hierarchy, the question of whether, well, we know from that interaction with the material in the sun that mass 2 is greater than mass 1, but we don't know whether mass 3 is greater than the rest of them. And so there is what's either called the normal or inverted hierarchy that is shown in the slide on the left. And this certainly comes into many things, including neutrinoless double beta decay. We also don't know the absolute mass of neutrinos. We know the differences because that's, in fact, what comes into the oscillation formula, as you can see here, 2-3 or 2-1. Is defined reasonably well, but we don't know what the absolute baseline is, and that's of significant interest, including in cosmology, although the limits these days are significantly small, that we know that neutrinos are not dark matter. So future experiments have the objectives of attempting to determine those things, but also for neutrinoless double beta decay, a question of whether the neutrino can effectively be its own antiparticle. And that's a reference to a Majorana neutrino, and it comes into the theory, as you'll see in a minute or two. So objectives now in SNOWLAB, which is an expansion of the underground laboratory from the original area over here, which was where SNOW was, to a significant, about a 3 times expansion of the underground excavated volume, it is ideal for many experiments, and in particular, Snow Plus, which I'll talk about in a moment, where we've renovated the Snow experiment to look at double beta decay. But you can see the set of different dark matter experiments that are situated there as well. One of them being the Deep 3600 experiment with argon. I don't know if you're hearing that. It's ringing in my hearing aids because my phone is ringing, but I'm ignoring it. Okay? A new phenomenon, all right? Whose phone is it? Just his ears. But what's interesting, and I've put the different target materials that we're putting in front of a beam, essentially, of dark matter. It's more a question of dark matter being in our galaxy and us going through it. But you can see argon, helium, silicon germanium, and fluorine. In fact, Pico 40, Pico already has the world's limit on dark matter interaction by spin-dependent interaction using fluorine and is expanding to get even greater sensitivity. The idea is to put a variety of different materials, different techniques for detecting dark matter. And so it's quite quite an array. Super CDMS is about to start construction. It's about a $40 million US project that has targeted SNOLAB as a location of interest. Two of the big neutrinos double beta decay experiments, NXO and Legend, are both interested in this space here, which is still empty for the future, and they're both in excess of $300 million. So this laboratory has become a very interesting place for future measurements in this field. It's ultra clean, and you can see the open space that I mentioned that still exists. This is actually Stephen Hawking, who twice visited underground. Of course, everyone who goes into work in the laboratory takes a shower and changes into lint-free clothing to maintain this radioactivity. For him, we couldn't do it, so we vacuumed him off above ground, and the mining company provided a filtered air rail car to transport him underground. But he was absolutely indomitable in terms of he wanted to get underground. He wanted to be able to see what's happening. He came in 1998 and again about a year before he passed away. He's just such an inspiring individual that all of our students who met him were greatly inspired. At that point, in the second visit, he could only twitch his right eyebrow in order to pick the words off the screen. But he persevered, asking questions. Very interesting. And his sense of humor is great. He was, in the first time he was there, he was talking about cosmic microwave background, 2 degrees above absolute zero, or as he put it, almost as cold as Sudbury in the wintertime. So a very inspiring individual, as everybody around here knows. So neutrinos double beta decay. There are some nuclei where ordinary beta decay is energetically forbidden, but double beta decay is energetically allowed. Now, if two neutrinos are emitted along with the two betas associated with it, then you have a continuum, as you see here on the right, and it's basically just the sum of a couple of ordinary beta decays. But in the case where a neutrino is its own antiparticle, you can have a situation where no neutrinos are emitted, in which case you're dealing with a monoenergetic peak if you sum the energy of the two electrons. And so from this point of view, it's a great test of whether or not the neutrino is a Majorana particle, but it's also sensitive to the actual absolute mass of the neutrinos in the process. So the theory is complicated. It's difficult because the nuclear physics of zero neutrino double beta decay involves different states in the nucleus than two neutrino case. And so you can't simply measure or get from the things that have been measured for the emission of two neutrinos, which in most cases have been observed. You can't use that directly to get the nuclear physics sorted out. And so it's a complicated process, and you can have uncertainties. You still have uncertainties of up to a factor of four or so in the calculations of the nuclear matrix element, which is shown as a part of the formula for the half-life for neutrinos double beta decay. The other components in it are a phase space factor and a quantity which is related to the absolute masses and also involves extensively these mixing angles, the ones that are determined by this matrix I showed you earlier that you obtain from neutrino oscillations. Now, and also a couple of additional phases. If we observe neutrinos double beta decay, we will have observed Majorana property for the neutrinos, violation of B minus L symmetry, and a sensitivity to the absolute mass. And so it's one of the top priorities in particle physics, and the very low radioactivity situation in our laboratory is what makes it possible to look for this. We're not the only ones looking at it. There are a lot of experiments internationally. The objective of the near-term experiments, including SNOW+, is to get into this region here, where if you plot the effective mass of the this m beta beta factor related to neutrino mass against the mass of the lightest neutrino, what's interesting is that you get actually a plot where the sensitivity of these experiments, which are currently about here on this plot, is very similar to the sort of sensitivity you get if you do fits to cosmology. And the fact that they are in the same ballpark is interesting, and they can inform each other in terms of what's happening here. The next generation experiments are attempting to get beyond the so-called inverted hierarchy region and down into where it can go if you have normal mass, where you can have a singularity and a very low value for this m beta beta. But of course, we're still in the region here, which is degenerate between these. It can be, if it's in this region, there's no problem. It could be either normal or inverted, and you could still get a finite signal if the neutrino is a Majorana particle. So what's been happening with SNOW is that it's been converted to SNOW+. My watch, I wanted to see what the time was. My watch says, try standing up. Okay. I'm doing it, all right? So what we've done with SNOW is to replace the heavy water with liquid scintillator. Linear alkyl benzene has been found to be an excellent new type of liquid scintillator in which one can dissolve organic forms of tellurium, which is the particular neutrinos double beta decay candidate that we want to study. It required a fair amount of conversion in ultra-clean conditions because the liquid scintillator is lighter than the surrounding water. We had to put in these red ropes to hold down the vessel as opposed to holding it up, which is obvious when you have heavy water, it's heavier than ordinary water. So that required a lot of drilling into the floor of the cavity while keeping everything clean and the rest of the detector and so on. So it took quite a while. But we've been running for several years with first water and now scintillator, and we are expecting to put in about 4 tons of liquid scintillator starting in 2023. In the meantime, we're studying with the liquid scintillator, we're studying things like the geoneutrinos from the Earth and also neutrino oscillations from the Bruce and Darlington reactors here in Ontario. This is the signal, the red is the signal that we would expect for the current limit on this m beta beta factor, which is around 100 millielectron volts or 0.1 electron volts. In the first loading, we would expect to have a signal that looks like the red in a situation where the background is dominated to some degree by the tail of the two neutrino signals, but also a number of other radioactivity signals which are quite controlled in the measurements we've made already. There's a future phase which is being considered where we would up this 0.5% roughly to 3% tellurium. Nice thing about tellurium is that naturally it has about 36% of the particular isotope you're interested in, tellurium-130, whereas other double beta decay experiments typically use germanium or xenon, where the percentage is less than 10%, and you require the isotopic enrichment of the particular isotope you're interested in. Xenon has an additional problem these days, and that is that it's about $10 million a ton, I'm told, just for xenon, even before you try to enrich it. The world supply has been limited, in part affected by the Ukrainian war. But this shows you a sample with 19% loading, which, as you can see, is relatively transparent still. So increasing that gives us a phase two. Now, in order to show you the sensitivity, it gets rather complicated, but perhaps not that complicated if I tell you the essence of this plot. What we're looking at is the effective mass of the neutrinos in that quantity that I described earlier on here. It's plotted against the effective half-life. It happens to be multiplied also by the phase-space factor. But of course, because there's uncertainty in these matrix elements, they are represented by a series of different calculations that are done by different techniques. The lines that are dotted here represent experiments that are in the future. The most recent experiment is the Kamlan-Zen experiment using xenon, and it has a sensitivity, as you can see, in this range, which is getting into the inverted hierarchy region, with no signal being observed so far. SNOW Plus and LEGEND are on the order of the same time scale. SNOW Plus expects to be in operation in 2024. LEGEND is just beginning its operation at 200 kilograms of germanium in that case. Kamlan-Zen expects to be able to go with the current configuration about that much further down into the inverted hierarchy region. If you look in the much longer term, experiments that haven't been funded as yet, in particular the two I mentioned that are targeting SNOLAB or potentially one in SNOLAB and one in Gran Sasso, are LEGEND and NEXO. And NEXO is shown right here, and it clearly has one of the greatest sensitivities. It will get well below the inverted hierarchy band. But again, at cost of 400 million or something like that. The LEGEND is the green, getting also down almost below the inverted hierarchy, and the red is the 3% for SNOW Plus. There's a variety of other techniques that are being used that have potential, and Steve Biller, one of my colleagues, has been come up with a completely off the wall idea of how you might do an experiment at 10 times the size of SNOW Plus, simply pointing out that at least the transparency of the liquid scintillator at that point of that amount of loading would enable you to do it. And then you could potentially get down, in fact, to the normal ordering region, and that would give you quite a limitation on neutrino mass, certainly less than less than a few millielectron volts at that point. So the potential is there in the longer term with perseverance in this type of experiment. So dark matter, I'm sure you've heard lots about it around here, many different signals, one of them being the classic question of the velocities of stars and spiral galaxies, where what's observed is something like this as a function of radius, and where if it was only the glowing matter, then you would see something that looks like this. But of course, there's other properties determined from things like the development of the large-scale structure and things like the bullet cluster in terms of it being weakly interacting. It has not been observed as yet in at the LHC. The LHC is trying to make it for the first time since the Big Bang. What we're dealing with is what is obviously here in our galaxy from the original Big Bang, which is what gives us this phenomenon here. But it's very complementary, the things that are being done. What we're looking for is, in this case, weakly interacting massive particles, and there certainly are possibilities within even supersymmetric theory for the lightest neutral particle that could have these sorts of properties. And what we're looking for is the interaction of these WIMPs with nuclei, and which we don't know. And so what we do is we plot the sensitivity curves of how strong that interaction could be. The deep experiment uses 3 tons of liquid argon in a configuration not so different from the Snow experiment. You're looking in at a central volume of three tons of liquid argon with a set of photomultipliers. And it takes advantage of a property of liquid argon, which is that for a nuclear recoil, then you have a situation where the light comes out with a decay constant of about 6 nanoseconds, whereas for gammas and betas, you have 1,300 nanoseconds in terms of the light output. So a nuclear recoil, which we can simulate with a neutron hitting our target, you get a very sharp signal. For background gammas, you get a very long signal. So we digitize each pulse and take the ratio of the initial light, the prompt light, to the total light. And what you see is there's tremendous discrimination, particularly against an isotope of argon that is present in atmospheric argon, argon-39. It's not present, as it turns out. It's suppressed by a factor of up to 1,400 we've measured for what you get from underground, and that's where we're going to get it for future experiments. But we were able to discriminate by factors of 10 to the 8th against these signals. What's plotted here is this quantity, the amount of prompt light, versus the PE is the number of photoelectrons produced, or in other words, the intensity of the light. You can see that the other things that produce nuclear recoils, particularly alpha decaying nuclei, give us signals. We're interested down in this very low energy region corresponding to the recoil of a nucleus after being hit by a WIMP. And our first publication showed no events after 230 days. We are upgrading the detector and we'll continue with our running. But we've also joined a very major international collaboration, over 400 scientists, over 14 countries. And the sequence is that right now we're running with 3 tons in Snow Lab. We're going to build 20 tons out of 100 total at Gran Sasso, a laboratory east of Rome. And then the collaboration is committed to coming back to Snow Lab with an even larger experiment, which will take us down to where neutrinos interfere with the signals, ironically for me as a neutrino hunter. So in the dark side experiment, it's slightly different. In addition to that property of discriminating against radioactivity with the light, we also add an electron field, an electric field, that enables us to drift electrons to the top of the detector and get a second signal. So much more massive detector. It actually fits inside a replica of the protodune liquid argon cryostat that was developed at CERN. And in fact, Marzio Nezzi, who developed that, is now part-time our project director on this project in Gran Sasso. So it's in the Gran Sasso laboratory, which is shallower than Snow Lab, but adequately deep for the purposes. This shows an interesting new technology where we're using acrylic, a very pure material, but coated with transparent but electrically conductive material. New detectors, silicon photomultipliers, are very attractive in terms of their properties. This is the sort of signal you get out for a single photoelectron, two, three, four, very, very nicely separated and capable of being put into large arrays. In order to get this underground argon, which we need for the low radioactivity, we have developed a extraction facility in Colorado where we're extracting from a carbon dioxide stream that otherwise is used to pressurize oil wells in Texas. And we can extract, in terms of the tests of the facility so far, tests of the extraction devices so far, about 90 tons a year in order to take a little over a year to fill our detector and potentially to go on to produce the 400 tons for the Canadian future experiment. The equipment is just being shipped from Italy to Colorado, and we expect to start on that in about a year. So this is this plot that I mentioned of potential or cross-section for interaction with nuclei. And that's on the vertical axis. On the horizontal axis is the mass of the WIMP that's producing the interaction. So you can see, this is the original results from the deep experiment here. Not as sensitive as the results from the xenon experiments, but the projection will be to improve that significantly with our upgrade. LZ has reported some initial results which indicate that they probably will get to this projected sensitivity. The red curve is what Darkside 20K can do, slightly better than LZ or xenon n-ton, and the 400-ton experiment, about 300-ton fiducial, running for 10 years, can get down to the point where neutrinos are interacting with the detector and interfering with the signals. Now, there's an advantage of argon over xenon when you get to that point, because we can get rid of altogether the interaction between an incoming neutrino and an electron by the discrimination properties. They have more limited ability to do that. When you get into this region and you talk about the neutrinos that are going to interfere, then their boron 8 neutrinos from the sun, ironically, are one of the problems, which we can handle better than the argon, better than the xenon can, and atmospheric neutrinos, which is what Super Kamiokande won the Nobel Prize for in observing oscillations. There's also a smaller version of the detector that would have even lower radioactivity and can get into this lower energy region here. So in summary, this field of particle astrophysics has become really a major part of the field. We've had a real advantage in the last 7 years with a Canada First Research Excellence Fund that's enabled us to hire 15 faculty members in this field, including some theoreticians, and we are moving forward now with a faculty component that matches the capabilities in the underground laboratory. So the questions that are being addressed in these underground laboratories are very fundamental, as I mentioned, and all of it gives you a lot of confidence in the way in which particle physics, cosmology, and particle astrophysics are coming together to give us as complete a picture as we can of our universe. Thank you. And thank you for the extra 5 minutes.
Yeah, thank you. Very good. So we have about 8 minutes for questions, and we have a cube here, so don't be shy. Okay.
Is this working? Oh, good. This is a very cool invention. That was a great talk. Can you comment on some of the new experiments that I've heard about that look at frequency measurements of the beta decay electrons? I'm thinking of Project 8, and there's also one at Catrin, which do electrostatic attempts to get the neutrino mass. So where are they on this?
So I didn't mention them, but if we go back to this plot of sensitivity for this M beta beta, which, as you know, is more complicated than simply the mass of the neutrino, what they're measuring by looking at the end point of tritium beta decay, and that's the case for Catrin, by looking explicitly at the electrons emitted with a very sensitive spectrometer. They're looking right at the end point and looking for curvature that might be indicative of a finite neutrino mass. Their most recent results are essentially here, at about 0.1. I'm wrong. They're up here around 1 electron volt, but they're aiming at 0.2 in their most extensive capability, longer term running with what they're running right now. They've reported, I think, most recently 1 electron volt. Previously, their limit was 2.2 or something like that. The Project 8 is a very interesting idea, where you put the tritium in a magnetic field, so you get cyclotron resonance, and you measure the RF and translate that into electron energy. It runs the risk that all attempts to look at the endpoint of something like tritium beta decay runs into, and that is the atomic effects associated with the fact that you really have to have high density. You have to have high density in order to get the counting rate. And so the projections I've seen for Project 8 are perhaps factors of 2 beyond the sensitivity for Catrin. Maybe better. Maybe they've improved it compared to what I saw, which is a few years ago. But it's hard to beat that problem of the resolution being smeared out by the atomic effects from the density of the material that you have to have in order to get a reasonable counting rate.
All right, thanks.
More questions? Okay, then you'll try to throw the cube to the chair.
But it's also on the same plot with the cosmology. I mean, this is amazing that you're that close with these different technologies in attempting to understand the problem. Yes?
I just returned from your place of your birth in Sydney, Nova Scotia. And I'm interested in the question, given the Glace Bay and the mines and all of the underground stuff that used to happen where you came from, is it ironic that you are now spending a lot of time underground in a different location?
Perhaps. My family didn't work in the mines, but ironically, I spent a summer working at the steam-generating electric power plant in Glace Bay, in fact, which ultimately provided the steam that produced the excess heavy water that Canada had in its reserves. So this was before they developed the heavy water plant, which was late 1960s. It was, I think, 1962 that I worked there. So there is a connection, but not as it happens through the mines. I have visited Cape Breton coal mines, and oh boy, the comparison between what you have in hard rock mining in Sudbury, where you have, you know, I think it's 13 by 14 feet wide drifts, whereas in the Cape Breton coal mines, the seams are compressing and you're going under the ocean and there's a lot of water coming in and so on. The conditions are much better. It would have been extremely difficult for us to think of doing an experiment in a mine like that. But nevertheless, I did understand the mentality, if you like, in the Sudbury region from having grown up in a mining region in Cape Breton.
Thank you.
Thanks for the question. Yes?
Hi, I'm wondering if you'd be willing to say a little bit about whether or how these different experiments approach blinding techniques for these hunts for rare detections?
Blinding techniques?
Yeah.
Yeah. So just in case everyone doesn't know what's being referred to, the worry you have when you're analyzing a large quantity of data is that the analyzers have in mind that they want to prove that neutrinos have, let's take snow as an example, that when they want to prove that neutrinos have oscillated or changed their flavor. So in the snow experiment, it's perhaps easiest to explain what we did. We took a sample of data that for the second reaction, which was the important one, the more difficult one to get quantitatively correct, the neutral current reaction. And we added in false data that only two people knew how much had been added in. And these were effectively nuclear recoils induced by neutrons. And we added it in, and we didn't remove it until the very last moment after everything else associated with how we are going to define our final results had been defined by the process of analysis. And then you take out the bad data and you have your result. And so we really ended up with a eureka moment because, you know, when everybody at the same time, granted some of them were on Zoom, but or whatever the equivalent was in those days, you had probably a telephone. You have an experience where people say, ah, finally I know the answer after I've been working at all of this. It's one way to do blindness, but you have to be really careful because if you add in data that is not as identical as you can make it to what is being added to, that is the signal for the neutral current, you can bias yourself. In this case, we did a lot of tests to make sure it was as similar as you could discern, and we think we did it right. Otherwise, in other experiments, we have a tendency only to analyze, I showed you the region of interest for deep. We analyze in the regions around that before opening the box, as it's called, for the inner region, so that you don't get biased in that inner region. More difficult, not necessarily as good a way of doing it as what we used in the snow experiment. Another question.
I would suggest that we leave the next questions for the coffee break, since we are right on time, and let's thank Art for this talk.